Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Corner Store. I am your host, Kevin Koval, and unfortunately without my co-host, Tara Mahadevan, who is on the road traveling. As you know, Tara is a hip-hop journalist, always staying, finding the freshest shit in the world. And so I think right now Tara's in Cali or something like that, doing her thing. And, you know, I'm excited for what she will be bringing to the Corner Store. We're going to introduce some new elements in our second year. But tonight, I'm super excited. This is a conversation I've been hoping to have for some time. We have in the Corner Store at WGN Radio someone who is an ambassador of, I would say, a new sound, a new style in jazz, someone who I think comes from, and I'm curious to get into the conversation, but comes from many different spaces sonically, and you hear all various elements in his music, but is one of the most profound new jazz drummers in the world, someone who has put Chicago new jazz on the map. Particularly him and his label, International Anthem, do incredible work for the city, both in the city and internationally. We have none other than Micaiah McCraven in the Corner Store tonight. Welcome, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
Yeah.
We have, just out the gate, we have some snacks for you from the Corner Store.
Yeah.
So you're enjoying a beverage from our sponsor, Stolen Spirits. Hope you're liking the whiskey.
Quite delicious.
Good. Thank you. Also, I got you, you know, some coconut water. I feel like you need to stay hydrated. And then in addition, this, I feel like, I don't know if these are going to be good or not, but I got you a Mediterranean nutritious savory bar with black olives and walnuts.
Okay.
I felt like I'm interested in that flavor. And then
this might be for my wife.
Okay, fair enough. And then in addition, for some reason I just felt like because you travel and shit, you're probably like healthier than most folks. I got you some Fuji apple freeze dried fruit crisps.
I should try to be healthy.
Yeah. Is it on the road? It must get tricky finding the right foods to eat and
yeah, it can be hard on the road eating healthy. Part of it I think is just the timing of being on the road and eating at odd hours, like, you know, eating when food is available, whether, you know, for traveling internationally, there's like, it's like you're hungry and you eat on the airplane and you land, or you don't eat and then you're hungry when you land and you go out to get some lunch wherever you are because you want to also, you know, maybe eat some local fare, and then you go to the venue and there may have dinner for you then. Or you might want to eat after the show. So it's like the timing and what's available, and depending on where you are, you know, what choices there are, it can be difficult. So
yeah, well, that's why you got to build all that into the young rider, right, as well. Have a really good rider.
Always ask for healthy snacks. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, you're right on.
we got
right
the rider.
The
yeah, we got the rider. Well, thank you for being here, man. I mean, our show is very much about the process of being and becoming a creative, and so curious about just where you come from, you know, to begin with.
I grew up in a musical household, artistic household. Both my parents are musicians. My father is a jazz drummer, African American, and my mother is a folk singer and multi-instrumentalist from Budapest, Hungary, as well as a visual artist. And you know, she came up doing some, you know, pottery and also painting, and she was sewing and then just different types of music and the Hungarian Eastern European diaspora. And then on myself personally, kind of growing up in the States, you know, quickly was just into the pop music of the day, you know, and hip hop and just kind of stuff my friends were listening to and what was kind of in my community. And just was always looking for ways to participate in the music that I enjoyed and that I was studying and learning. That was always kind of a goal of mine, was if I heard something, I wanted to learn how to play it or meet people that did it or understand more about how it was made and where it came from and what it was about. And so, you know, because I've always wanted to be a musician that felt that I strive to feel like you could plop me down in anywhere and I could play with some musicians and we could work something out. And so that's always been something I've wanted to be able to do.
Yeah. Were you born in the States or were you?
I was born in Paris.
Yeah.
I was born in Paris, but we quickly moved to the States. So I grew up in the United States since I was about 2 years old.
Okay. And whereabouts you grow up?
I grew up in Western Massachusetts, in the Pioneer Valley. It's just kind of small college area with several prominent schools in the area and a lot of incredible artists and musicians that lived in the area. So I grew up with a really great community outside of my direct family, who were either were the kids of artists and musicians and artists and musicians themselves. But, you know, everything from writers to writers and poets to visual artists and everything. And it was a really, I thought it was a cool community. It was a small and kind of rural feeling space, but you know, for such a small space, it has a high volume of creatives and academics and transients that come from a variety of different places. And that, you know, I think that
it's cosmopolitan in that way.
It's cosmopolitan,
even though it's,
even
rural,
though it's very
Mass.
Rural in yeah. Massachusetts. So I feel like I have best of both worlds in that sense. And you know, it was a really
It sounds like
ground.
A very special childhood then in that regard.
Yeah, you know, and it's really cool to see a lot of the people I came up with doing a variety of amazing things.
Some of your peers.
Yeah, my peers are.
Who are some of those folks?
I was just hanging with my friend. Alicia Shakur, and she's a singer. She sings with the Tedeschi Trucks band, and you know, she's done a bunch of stuff in the music industry with Soul Live and all these, you know, kind of interesting artists, East Coast kind of vibes. You know, and to friends that have gone on to make kind of creative adjacent businesses. You know, my buddy Mike Kurtz of Mike's Hot Honey. He has an incredible honey business.
Oh,
that
wow.
makes spicy
yeah.
honey,
yeah.
and they're distributed all over the, the country and internationally, and is quite successful. So, you know, people who just kind of like are creative, and
right.
you know, he worked in the music industry before he did that, and that was other common ground. But we all, you know, went to high school and grew up together.
That's really cool. So, I mean, that's a very interesting
among,
mesh.
You know, a bunch of people. You know,
your household seems ripe with all these ideas. Were you pushed into being if your dad's a drummer, you're a drummer? Is that how it worked, or when were you able to pick up the sticks yourself, or how did that happen?
There was a bit of like, dad's a drummer, you're a drummer, but not like forcefully, but just because this is available and this is was the house.
He has a drum, so you have a drum.
There's drums in the house,
right?
We live in a small apartment,
right?
He sits me on his lap to play drums. You know, this is where there was a thing we could bond on. And then by the time I was five, you know, before I was, you know, I'd be crawling in the bass drum or be around rehearsals as a little kid. I'd have to go to my mom's music lessons when she taught voice lessons. I'd have to sit through that often, or when she was a student at UMass getting her music degrees when she went into music education. I'd often have to tag along if my father was on the road, sit around rehearsals. But then it was by the time I was five, I got introduced to a situation where I was doing some playing, and it was a percussion ensemble my dad was teaching with a bunch of kids, ages like some kid that was close to my age, around 6-7, to, you know, 21-year-old, and about, I don't know, I think there's maybe 10-11 of us. And he created a drum ensemble that spanned a huge span of skill levels. You know, and for me, I could have a little part, you know, just like, doom, 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 clap. You know, and that was my part.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, there's all these, you know, other more intricate parts. And then the, you know, eldest of the group would be playing drum set along with it. And, you know, it was a really cool way to learn percussion. Then, you know, throughout the years, there were different opportunities for me at young ages to be engaged with like bands or school bands that were not necessarily directly from like my public school, but were things like directed by other people my father knew who they needed another young musician that could accomplish, you know, we need a drummer for our, this like, you know, little jazz group we have of students, you know, and I got pulled into that, you know, being a little younger than some of the other kids. So I had some opportunities to play with peers from a young age, but also to get invited to sit in with my dad and his friends at a rehearsal or even a show.
Yeah, who are some of the folks that your dad played with? And what are your parents' names, too?
My dad, Stephen McCraven, continues to work a lot with Archie Shepp.
Yeah.
We're working with Sam Rivers and Yusuf Lateef. He's, you know, a bunch of different records under his own name. And that was always an inspiration of mine, you know, how he was really involved in self-producing records as a drummer.
Which is fairly rare.
And really, you know, relatively independent terms, independent labels.
Right.
You know, these vinyls are quite rare, you know. I don't even know how many of them were ultimately pressed.
Yeah.
And some of them are on European, you know, small European labels. And, you know, something that I think is much more common now, you know, but in the 90s and 80s.
Didn't have the same access, didn't have the same technology.
It was much harder to say, like, we're going to self-produce a vinyl.
Right.
You know? And then my mother, Agnes Zsigmondy, she grew up in Hungary and was part of a group called Kalinda, which was a politically kind of vocal group that did Eastern European folk music across kind of borders, you know, engaging with gypsy music and Jewish music and some musics that were really kind of had the borders of like national borders that crossed between them. And you know, they were quite outspoken about that and using music as a tool to talk about, you know, where they're from, their people and migration and all that kind of stuff.
Wow. It's pretty beautiful.
And you know, both, even my dad, his music was very much genre crossing, you know, the stuff he was doing with Archie Shepp, often was, you know, going into African folk music, you know, West African music, as well as, my dad was into rock and roll and Jimi Hendrix, and there was all these elements in his music that were always kind of open-minded and pushing genre, and those things were big influences into just like how I approach music and feeling open and feeling like that's something that is just inherently what I want to do.
Yeah, well, and certainly on your records, you're pushing multiple boundaries and blurring these borders. Are they're your folks are still around, still married?
Yeah, no, they're not married, but they're around. My father moved back to Paris, and my mother's back, still in Western Massachusetts.
So what do they think about what you're doing? It makes sense to them, obviously. They're proud.
They're extremely proud. You know, they're very supportive. You know, every time I go through Paris, my dad shows up
Have you all done shows together, you and your
father? Yeah, I've done shows I've done some recording with my father some years ago. We haven't really played like in public for quite a while, but I used to work with my mom all the time. I mean, she gave my band, my early band in high school, our first gigs.
Wow.
You know, backing up her music when she was performing locally. And, you know, she would have all these odd time signatures, 7/8, 5/8, 9/8. And it was a, you know, challenge for some young musicians. And I think she just kind of heard us jamming and practicing and was like, these guys can learn this. And then she started to introduce this stuff to us and got us some shows and really introduced us to the first clubs where we were able to get our own gigs as like a trio, which that really spurred that unit of musicians to, you know, really solidify as my first real band. Mm. And we really had a whole career from there, spanning over 10 years.
Oh, wow. What's the name of the band? And what years are we in when this is going down?
We're talking like 99, maybe, when that band really first came together for a high school battle of the bands, maybe 98 or 99. And we won the battle of bands, or it might have been a talent show, you know. And we started to do gigs with my mom and started to do some stuff locally. You know, I was a sophomore in high school, and the band, you know, first it was a trio, but it evolved into a band called Cold Duck Complex, which was that trio, you know, was, you know, it kind of evolved, but with a rapper.
Oh, word.
And we were a live kind of hip hop band with a jazz trio that kind of did it. And, you know, that sounds really like, you know, you see that all the time now, but like back then there was really not a lot of examples for this.
Roots came out, what, 94, 5 or something
we knew
like
the
that?
Roots, so, yeah. And I remember seeing the Roots, and I was a fan of the Roots.
Would you go to the Black Lily or the...
The Roots came and they played at Smith College in Northampton.
Okay. Right.
In like a theater on campus.
Right.
And I remember being there, like second row, And, you know, it's like, wow, this is really great. You know, and our band sound was different. And then, like, it evolved into, like, having some more rock edges and, you know, some things that kind of resembled maybe Rage Against the Machine. But there was also, like, some more jazz elements and some jam band elements. And, you know, we had this, like, you know, very virtuosic rapper, really smart guy. He's a professor in African-American studies now. He's a white, white rapper. Really great.
What's his name?
His name, we go by Platypus Complex.
Okay.
You know, and his name's Casey Heyman, but he's a really smart dude, had a lot of incredible things to say. And we were able to, like, garner, like, a really kind of like a culty, small culty following in the Northeast, you know, starting first as, like, a high school band in our hometown. But, you know, while I was still in high school and those guys got to college, next thing you know, we were, you know, we won the college gala bands,
right.
And we opened for 50 Cent and Rozelle and Real Big Fish for the spring concert, you know. And I was a senior in high school,
yeah,
you know, and this was at the local university, and we got to play in an arena. And then from there we were starting to sell out, you know, local clubs and being able to trade shows with bands in New York or Boston. And we started to play out, you know, and really did quite well in the college circuit in the Northeast as well, doing a lot of college gigs and stuff. And that was my first taste of being like of doing any sort of touring. You know, we were loading up our cars. We really organized a business-wise. The bass player, who really kind of took over the management role, had a really smart mind for music industry. And, you know, we ran our own radio campaigns. We did street teaming.
Wow.
All of the bands,
yeah,
all the band stuff, you know?
Right.
We did it, you know? And I felt like when I moved to Chicago later, after that kind of period of my life was kind of changing, and entering the jazz market, you know, not all the cats out there had the same experience, like building, like, an indie vibe,
yeah.
You know, not in the jazz world, it's a little different, you know.
The hustle is different,
a little more top down.
Yes.
And I'm really grateful for that.
Right.
I mean, I learned a lot, I hustled a lot.
It gave you a different perspective about the market.
Yeah, we opened for all sorts of people, from Diggable Planets to The Far Side, you know, Mixmaster Mike, Lyricist Lounge. I mean, we did a bunch of cool stuff.
Why did that band break up?
You know, over a lot of time and a lot of fights in intimate relate, you know, like your brothers, we were
10
like,
years, a long time.
Yeah, it was. Oh, yeah. And we started really young. We were kind of locked into the culture that started from a long time ago. There were other kind of business things that were happening that were also complicating stuff. You know, people found different things in their lives, were like figuring out where they're going, you know, from whether it's graduate school to, you know, one of the band members, like, you know, followed his spirituality into being a monk for some time. You know, I was starting to come to Chicago where my wife was, you know, we weren't married at the time.
But you were interested in being married to her.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like there was just a lot of things and we eventually, you know, we were just kind of grew up a little bit out of that project, and we held on. I mean, we were still playing well into when I moved to Chicago. You know, we got to a place where I could fly out for stuff, and also through that band, you know, we got involved with a studio and venue called the Pushkin in Western Mass as well, and I became the musical director. So I was also producing records and organizing shows and doing this stuff, and I was really young, and there was a lot going on for me out there. And when I moved to Chicago with the band and with this studio and venue, I was really kind of, for the first couple years in the city, I was kind of in between here and in the East Coast.
Okay.
That really gave me some cushioning, as I didn't know anybody in Chicago, and I started from scratch.
So how did you first start to come to Chicago? Was it because of your wife then?
Yeah, she was a tenure track position at Northwestern, and I would come out for like 6 months. I came out once a month.
How did y'all meet?
We met through mutual friends in a bar.
Okay.
You know, in Amherst.
Okay.
And then I was coming out, and as I came out, every time I came to Chicago, I was doing my research. Where are the cats?
Yeah.
Who do I want to play with?
So where were the spots session? That you were going to? Because
every week I go to the Velvet Lounge. Yes.
When it was on Indiana or when it had moved to Cermak? Yeah.
Cermak. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right there on the South Loop in Cermak. I'd go every Sunday that I was in town. And when I moved here.
Fred was alive.
Fred was there. Yep. And Fred was very encouraging to me from the moment I stepped in there.
Well, what an encouraging and important presence in Chicago's music scene.
Absolutely. Right? I mean, I got my first gig as a leader in Chicago at the Velvet Lounge directly from Fred. So, you know, I met all of, you know, my oldest collaborators, probably. They're not everybody, but a lot of us, you know, we all went there. And same with the new apartment lounge.
Yes, Vaughn's.
Vaughn Freeman's, you know, on 83rd, I think it was.
Maybe 75th. I don't know. Yeah.
But just going out there. And then, you know, just more. I mean, I was looking for beat nights. You know, this is before I was really doing too much making beats, but I was really interested. And so I used to go to like random like beat nights they had at there was this place, the Morseland, and they used to have a beat night, and that was right around the corner from us. And I used to go out there, and that's where I met like producers and like learned about some other like spots and underground spots, Q4 Gallery, you know, back in Humboldt Park. Like, met a lot of cats. A lot of cats who are doing some like big stuff now.
Yeah,
you know
who are some of the folk, both in terms of because. I didn't know that you were not from Chicago, and part of the reason is because your musical lineage seems to have a lot to do with Chicago music, at least aesthetically, the ethos a little bit.
Well, you know, it's interesting, like, dealing with the avant-garde of jazz. I mean, guys like Archie Shepp and Sam Rivers and Yusuf Lateef may not be part of the AACM, may have a different kind of, come from a different angle, but there is, you know, some adjacency there, and historical period and similarities.
Influence.
So when I came here and I walked into the Velvet Lounge, distinctly remember walking in the Velvet Lounge and seeing like the last song of the Great Black Music Ensemble with Ernest Dawkins, you know, and like, okay, check these cats out. And they're, you know, I got these guys dashiki on. I was like, okay, that's, you know, I have a frame of reference for this, okay? So that was the first thing, and it was really cool. And then right after was the jam session.
Yes.
And I remember seeing these cats like Junius Paul, who I work with all the time, and Corey Wilkes, and just a lot of, you know, and then guitar player like Scott Hesse, you know, these guys. And this was like the house band, and just remember seeing them play and the energy and them playing jazz standards, but also having reference to the avant-garde and
the hip hop, really,
and the young black musicians that are into hip hop, avant-garde, and straight ahead jazz. And like, and I was like, oh wow, these are my people.
Right.
Like, this makes sense to me,
right?
You know, and so it wasn't like it's from Chicago, but it just, we had like their similar set of influences, and you know, it felt really good, that environment. Mm-hmm. And I made a point to, like, you know, go religiously. You know,
right?
I kept notes.
Sundays, is that Sundays, what they said at the gym? Yeah,
I went, but I also went to. I tried to show up everywhere. I really took it on myself as a job, because I've having a full career on the East Coast. With my band was really busy with side gigs, programming shows, doing studio session. I had a lot going on as a young musician, and it's like, say, okay, now I'm gonna move to a big market city, and I don't know a soul really. Like, if I want to maintain being a professional musician, because I wasn't working any sort of day job for, you know, since, you know, my freshman year of college, last time I had like a little side job. When I moved here, I was like, I don't want to go backwards. What do I need to do to meet everybody in any genre that I can, that I'm interested in and working, and start to have a professional career and support myself through my art? And it was all about that.
Yeah,
you know,
going out, palm to palm,
and meeting people, and figuring out who I want to meet, and what are the scenes, and where are the gigs, and what's available. And Chicago being a really great working class music town, where there's lots of brunch gigs and jobbing gigs and jazz clubs and rock clubs and DJ. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to make a little bit of money. You know, if it really,
if you're down to work,
if you're down to work,
yeah.
You know, and everybody has their way that they go about doing things. And, you know, but I've always been fine with being like, you know, a music laborer as well as an artist, you know?
Right.
And so my perspective is always just prioritizing art, always prioritizing my sound, always prioritizing my direction and how I want to go about doing things. Not saying that I'm not going to do things, but I'll prioritize it. So if it's ever a choice between a work gig or something that's building towards my career, building like my profile or building my artistic goals and endeavors, then I always prioritize that.
Yeah.
No matter what. That's always been kind of a thing for me. But I've always taken the position of like to hustle.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you had that ethic before you came, but I think that ethic does embody the kind of way people approach art in this city.
Yeah, and I think that's it's a working class town.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a no frills town. I don't feel like you can come to Chicago and just put a sweet pair of sunglasses on and get on the bandstand. It's not gonna fly.
Yeah.
You know,
you get punched. But
yeah, there's some other cities where that might work actually.
Yeah.
You know,
who were some of the in that moment, who were some of the hip hop heads that you were gravitating towards, building
here
with,
in
influenced
Chicago?
By here in Chicago in that? Because this is what the late 2000s, the late aughts. Is that when you came initially or?
I'm saying that again.
Like around 2008, 2009. When you
2007,
came?
Maybe.
Okay.
2007, 2008. Well, you know, going, I remember going at first, one of the people connected with was Maker. It's a beat maker.
It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. I remember
Galapagos 4.
Yeah, Galapagos 4. I remember seeing him and like seeing that he had a lot of like serious stuff happening and making.
He's
dope.
No, he's.
I was like, I gotta hook up with this dude.
Yes.
And we did some hanging. But then I started doing some gigs with DJs. There's this DJ, Murray the Mayor, you know. And he's in the Bay now, but he like, we met at Q4 and he wanted to do some like drum DJ duos. And then he started to get us gigs, you know, he just was like, yeah, I got this gig at the Dark Room. And
right,
we started doing a series
room.
At yeah. Rodin.
Yes.
And we started playing Rodin like every other Saturday, you know. And I remember knowing about Rodin because one of the first people I wanted to hook up with when I moved to Chicago was Jeff Parker, who had a great series at Rodin, and I remember going to that. And
of Tortoise. This is Jeff of Tortoise.
Jeff Parker of Tortoise.
Yeah.
But he also, you know,
a lot of side projects. Yeah. Yep.
You know, he was a big inspiration when I moved to Chicago. Because
yeah.
I remember.
Incredible musician. Yeah.
Incredible mind, everything. You know, and I remember become a good friend and a mentor and all of those things. But I remember going to the Rodin and seeing him, and they're doing this really free jazz kind of night where they're improvising all night, but in between their sets is like DJs, and it's at this like hip,
yeah, with
cocktail
cool
lounge
visuals
sushi
on the
bars.
Back.
Yeah, they got like visuals.
Yeah,
and I was like, wow,
I miss that spot now. I
was like, how are
too.
They playing this experimental music, and it's not just driving all the hip people out of here,
yeah.
You know? And that was really like dope. I was like, oh wow, they can. There's a cross section where these musics are existing. And where people want to hear this experimental progressive music, you know, but also are down with like hip hop and stuff. And then I started looking into Jeff Morgan. I was like, the indie rock band Tortoise, and like they were really amazing. And then on his MySpace page, he was making beats and DJing, and his tracks sounded dope. And then like you look at his, and he's playing with the AACM and Avant Garde, and then he's on tour, next thing you know, with Joey DeFrancesco playing like straight ahead, like kind of organ jazz. And and I was like, man, this cat does what he wants,
right?
Musically
can't
is open, you know, that's what I want to do,
right?
That was a big, he was really big influencer, just a inspiration, just saying like, okay, you do a lot of different things, that's okay, because a lot of the times when you're trying to work a lot or you're trying to like find your way into a scene, you get you know, pigeonholed this way, or you feel like you have to.
There's a rigidity sometimes. Yeah. And people will want to define you or tell you what
you can
or can't do.
Even if it's something that's really open-minded genre or progressive genre, you know, you still end up having to fall within line of like the tenets of that space.
Do you still struggle with that?
Absolutely. All the time.
Because I mean, you know, not to jump all the way ahead, but your last record, Universal Bean, you know, the first track in particular is like damn near, like it's a very brief, damn near just straight ahead hip hop instrumental. I thought that you produced that and are playing drums on it.
Yeah. It's all produced in a similar fashion.
Okay. Yeah. And I want to talk about how it's produced, but even that first track, I would imagine maybe you caught, you know, maybe, you know, health from, or, you know, because.
Yeah, I mean.
Because it's outside of what you might expect on a traditional.
Yeah, I mean, musically, I think right now is a good time. And I think a lot of people have been very gracious towards me and the music and the process, you know. You know, so I think there is some space for different types of sounds and whatnot. But I don't know. It's there are these gatekeepers and these things you have to deal with.
But some of that shit is dying. Yeah,
some of it's dying, and some of it doesn't really matter. Yeah. Because if people like the music, people are gonna like the music.
Right.
And that's really my perspective. It's like whatever. I want to make compelling music. I want to make music that makes people feel stuff or is memorable, that sounds and feels timeless, and connects with people. And if it does that, like all that other stuff doesn't really matter to me as much, you know?
Well, and it certainly does. I mean, your music, I think, crosses between, you know, I consider myself a bit of a jazz head because hip hop introduced me to jazz and because of, you know, my nerddom and desire to dig through the samples that were on the backs of records and the liner notes of records that I was listening to coming up. And so that introduced me to, you know, multiple genres of music. But because, you know, I'm an 80s, 90s hip hop kid, you know, primarily it was jazz and funk and soul samples. Right. And so that opened me to those genres of music. And I think your music works in multiple spaces. I mean, your records bump like a jazz, like a hip hop record. And they also, I think, satisfy like the things about jazz that I really love and appreciate. I've heard you talk. I'm interested in how you record, because how you record also very much utilizes the piecing of hip hop sample based culture.
Yeah. So like, you know, it's very much in a sample based manner that I've been making these records. And so in a way, you know, a lot of it is about the source material, right? It's about the source material. So it's about the space which we recorded, what we recorded, and who's making it, you know? And so, you know, very much like I try to pick great musicians that are open and who can really improvise well, and we can create a great first experience, because like a lot of these things are based out of live performances that are improvised. And the reason being is that there's a magic in the air when you're improvising like that. And it's not always something that I feel like for everybody is like the listen that they want, like start to finish. To be there, I think, is particularly special for an improvised show. But like in record making, and so like, you know, I try to create an environment where I can bring like world-class musicians together who can collaborate and spontaneously compose together, you know, and everybody is a composer on the piece. And then I take that material and then I'll like chop it and I'll reorient that source material to have more form. I'll edit it to form into a piece that has a more defined narrative, so to speak. And that takes you, you know, through a different type of listening. I might overdub some keyboards of myself or some percussion. I might add a couple little melodies or things or nuances out of it, or I might hear something completely new, or sometimes I'll take the track and I'll start pitching the whole track. And I,
Yeah, you act as a producer. I mean, yeah, you're not only...
I'm chopping, I'm doing right. like this same stuff as like when I've been like checking out
Pete Rock. Or, yeah.
Yeah, checking out Pete Rock, flipping samples and all the ways that he can do it. And it's like, wow,
yeah,
that is amazing. And that was an inspiration to me, you know, watching a Pete Rock video. I went on YouTube and the way he flipped the sample like completely... He chopped it into 32 bits on the MPC, and then he just played him. He just played it backwards,
right?
And it was like a whole new song. And I was like, "Wow,
yeah,
boom! Look, there's new ways of interpreting sound, interpreting music, and I've always loved beat tapes, and so it's just kind of
and then all it's all sample free because you're also
it's all sample free, you know,
because you're sampling yourself.
Yeah, I'm sampling myself and like the artists. Myself and everybody on the track are collaborators on that, you know?
That's very tedious, it sounds like, that process.
Yeah, it can be a little bit. Yeah, right. I spend hours and hours and hours like chopping or figuring out different ways to chop, whether I'm going to do it hardware-based or if I'm going to do it in the box.
What programs do you use when you...
Usually I'm like mostly just Ableton.
Yeah.
Okay. You know? And everything I do is basically two-track audio.
Wow.
No stems.
Wow.
And it's just like, to me, that resembles hip-hop.
Yeah.
You know, sampling off of a record. Right. You know, from the same 90s style kind of sample-based hip-hop is with my probably biggest inspiration there.
Right. You just have to account for so much sound as opposed to be able to pick and choose in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, we wouldn't even... There's so much bleed in the recordings that you don't really even have the option. So I'd rather not even deal with it. And there's something to the limitation of working like the records that I liked.
Right.
You know, that inspired me to, like, even experiment with this is to keep it simple like that and similar type of... limitations.
You've had a big year, a big bunch of years in a row. Beforehand we were talking, I mean, you're spending a lot of time touring, a lot of time overseas. I know that there is, I'm curious. So I feel like there is a new frontier, a new sound, a new appreciation for the kind of jazz that you, and I don't, I imagine it's still jazz in your mind, like even as a genre, or beyond the definition. Is the definition not even useful, perhaps?
I think that's a difficult thing to define.
Sure.
And so, like, I generally speak with like, in vague terms or even as a devil's advocate, because I think there is some amount of discussion and back and forth, you know, and paradox that it can all exist within, you know, when it comes to ownership and appropriation and legacy and history and where the music can go. But ultimately, like, you know, I avoided calling myself a jazz musician for years, as a young musician, feeling that the word jazz was a bad word and that was going to isolate me from having certain opportunities, you know, for a healthy career in the arts, you know, and that was sad, you know, to feel that way. Because, you know, very much I feel like this is my music and the music of
and your
my
legacy. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And to feel like, oh, so what kind of musician? You're a jazz musician? No. I play all kinds of music.
Right.
Yeah, including jazz.
Right.
And I play hip hop. It was like something I had to like prove that I wasn't, you're not just like, you know, square or straight in some way. And that's really sad that like jazz music that was so progressive and subversive and political throughout his history has become something that would be associated with being square,
yeah,
you know, yeah. or
well, anytime there begins to be, you know, and I worry about this sometimes, and how, you know, when hip hop becomes part of the academy,
institutionalized,
yeah, the Jazz Institute, which is dope, but also the idea of an institute, I think, makes it almost like classical music then.
Yeah, and but, you know, fair enough. You know, there is good reasons why people of jazz, you know, wanted to be recognized by institutions.
Absolutely.
Right? Because we want access to to money and donors and
prestige and respect.
Yeah. Prestige, you know, often, you know, for a lot of the black musicians who were creating jazz, they didn't have the same platforms as their white counterparts in classical music and have the same access to money. They didn't have the same access to tenure positions at universities to teach. There were no jazz programs. It wasn't respected, you know, and so there was a push, you know, by the elders to get respect, yes, to have a seat at the table, you know, and I think that's, I'm in support of that.
Yeah.
You know, I've had my own benefit of that, of being, you know, a young musician to older jazz musicians, and then even having the opportunity to have an education at a jazz school, you know, or like in a program. That these things exist. So,
well, your generation. So, this was my question: is like, I feel like your generation, and I wonder who you include in that. I have some ideas about some of your peers, at least, are changing that notion. And I ask in part because traditionally, a lot of heads would have to go to Europe in order to have a sustainable career as an artist, whereas the States were not necessarily supporting black artists, particularly black jazz musicians, particularly. And so, you know, you might be able to get more love and more money in Europe.
That's
or
why my dad was in Paris.
In Paris, yeah. But you, I think of, you know, I don't want to lump you in to other folks, but I feel like there are. I think a lot about the L.A. scene that is also blurring jazz and hip hop in multiple genres.
It's been happening for a long time.
Of course,
and I don't find this is like a moment that's just happened out of nowhere.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
I mean,
yeah, fusion is where.
I mean, Miles Davis made a hip hop record in the 80s, late 80s.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
With Eazy-Mo B.
Yeah, and there's been, you know,
Herbie, of course,
Herbie,
Branford,
Buckshot, LaFunk, Roy Hargrove.
Yes, yeah.
You know, obviously, you know, the Roots, which is
Diggable,
like,
Planets.
Know, Diggable Planets, but also, you know, Jazzmatazz, and I mean, there's been a lot of crosstalk, you know, and like if it was the 70s, it was with funk music. You know, and so I do think it's part of a similar narrative. You know, I don't always like to like think of everything as like we're in this
new era.
You know, this is the current thing.
Iteration,
And I think there is a great audience that has kind of opened up, and that to me is a little bit more unique. Is like, okay, well, you know, what is the. Not that the music is inherently different or bringing young people, but the young people have an open mind or open ear to it because of whatever the state of our society is or where the music industry is, and that gives us like a platform and open ears, and there are certain artists that I saw that kind of gave me inspiration, and when I saw it's like, oh wow, this music is. You know, it's jazz. It's like jazz oriented, but it's like this. But look at all these people,
right?
You know,
right?
And there, that was kind of what I was getting to before, was that there was definitely a point where it's like, you know what? No, I'm not afraid of calling myself a jazz musician, because I don't think it will turn away fans or people. You know, actually, I'd rather embrace that. Mm. And if there are like divergent views of what that means. You know, I can embody it in the way that it means to me, you know, and like there are elements of like the history of jazz, like progressive music, attempt to mastery of craft in your in instrument, you know, connection to the blues and the oral traditions of the music and elements of groove and jazz and all these things actually you could attribute to like this a more conservative definition of what jazz is. It's like, you know, I can still use those, you know, while being progressive, you know, or there's multiple ways of defining it and which really kind of makes that a undeniable truth is if you look at the history of jazz and the amount of different movements in the music that have happened and the amount of times that it's been deconstructed or recontextualized or reimagined. I mean, there was a time when bossa nova, which fits well into more traditional jazz, was the new thing, And that's really what it meant. It was this moment where, like, in like the music, jazz and Brazilian music combined and connected and created a whole new wave and new sound.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the amazing things
about the music. It's elastic in that sense.
Yeah.
And you know, border erasing in that regard, back to your own familial experience.
And look at guys like Dizzy Gillespie, who started, you know, being ambassadors for the music and really traveling and bringing jazz and to a lot of places around the world that didn't have access to it, you know. And it's just the ability to, like, you know, to kind of be fluid and connect with a variety of different styles and sounds, you know. And whether it's rooted in, like, this or then the avant-garde and you know, just deconstructing things or challenging the status quo is also, I think, a really kind of a legacy of the music that I'm really interested in exploring.
Yeah, and of course, as always, you know, that's a central trope in jazz, it seems, too, is that jazz has always been, from its onset, of course, been interested in challenging, countering
the status quo, the dominant narrative. There lies the paradox, because we're also here talking about, like, honoring the legacy and paying homage to and evolving of a tradition,
living in a tradition,
Which but I think often, like, maybe, you know, oral tradition flows a little bit more like a game of telephone.
Yeah,
you know, it's when you write it down on paper, then it's like you start to get stuck.
Yeah, right. That's real. That's real.
You know, and it's like, no, that's just the way it goes.
Right.
That's it.
It's codified now.
The same thing.
It's the Bible
with the idiom of recorded music versus the live thing that can be open and it's in the moment and it's now.
Yeah.
You know, you put it on record, you know, now that...
That's the version you expect.
That's the version you expect.
As opposed
to... And it's funny, you know, like, you know, if you're in a cover band or something and the band leader is like, okay, we're going to play this song. And I'll go and I'll be like, oh, let me go check it out on YouTube. And if I learn the version of the artist playing it live, that might not be the version, because we got to do it like this because that's the record. But it's like, but when they played it live, they played it like this.
Right.
They didn't do how they did on the record. You know, I always found that kind of a funny thing, you know, because I was like, oh, I learned it. Oh, you learned it the wrong way. You didn't do it the right way.
Yeah. Well, I think you said it. We get stuck. We get stuck as a culture. We get stuck as a, you know, in a mental state.
Yeah.
And that prohibits our growth, really.
It can, you know, but there's something also to be said for
standards
and learning the tradition and taking part. And that's where the oral tradition, because when you stand next to a master and it's not like the book is telling you not to do it this way or the recording. It's like you're standing next to the cat or the guy who is actually stood there next to Charlie Parker. Then you play it the way he tells you to play it.
Well, that's
you learn from your elder and you learn from the masters. And that, to me, is the shit.
Yeah.
You know,
we have the
essence
privilege
of oral tradition.
I'm sorry. We have the privilege of standing recently with Roscoe Mitchell. And it felt that way. It felt like you were in the presence of a master. You wanted him to tell you what the fuck to do, and he would tell you what the fuck to do.
Yeah, you know, it's like, it's like,
go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, you seem like someone, and even, you know, your catalog is someone who you continue to push yourself as a musician. What is next? What are you working on?
Oh, man, so many.
I'm sure.
So many, like, projects kind of in the works right now. Some short terms. We're working on a remix record for Universal Beings. Got some catalog stuff happening. Finally repressing In the Moment again, which has been out of press for a while. I've got a studio record that I've been working on for quite a while. That's just kind of in tweaking mode. And we're in the planning stages for, like, another recording project for 2020, as well as some kind of large scale performances that I'll have coming up from the end of the year to into 2020, and some other projects. As
beautiful,
well.
Man. Well,
kind of a lot of stuff.
I just saw you tear down the Jazz Showcase. Can people see you in Chicago coming up?
April 25th will be at the Empty Bottle. And I'm really looking forward to that one. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
A different vibe than the Jazz Showcase.
Yeah.
The repertoire might be a little different. But that's one of the things I also, you know, I love working with musicians that are versatile. It's like my first thought when I'm calling people. People can hit a lot of different types of sounds and genre. And I like to be able to play in different spaces. It's like, you know, whether it's a standing room show or, you know, we got a show coming up in Portland, opening for Rakim. So if we're doing like a hip hop show, or if we're playing in a more of a jazz room, where we can be a little more acoustic, a little more open, a little more solo vibes versus like, you know, a set where we're really kind of rocking out. And yeah. I enjoy
not different methods.
Yeah, different methods, yeah. Places. And, you know, the band will augment, you know, and I just try to get amazing musicians to work with. And, you know.
Yeah. Where can people find you, and where can people find the work on the internet?
MakayaMcCraven.com. It's MakayaMcCraven.com. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
Wow.
MySpace.
Listen.
LinkedIn.
Talk about it.
You know, and some other ones I'm forgetting too.
Well, yo, I feel like I want to talk for another 4 hours, but your kids are here, and I really appreciate you being here, and I really am excited about your continued contribution to the sonic space around the planet and in the city. So thank you, man. Thanks for being here.
Exactly.
Yo, we want to thank DJ Exist for the beat.
Langston Olsen for the art.
Big ups, Todd Manley at WGN Radio.
And Max and Dami, the Corner Store interns.
Salutes to our super producer, DJ Cash Era.
You can keep in tune with the Corner Store at @_pod on Instagram, Twitter, and SoundCloud.
Also, you can stream and download the Corner Store wherever you listen to podcasts.
And please rate and subscribe and comment on iTunes.
Please, y'all, consider giving us those 5 stars.
Thank you for listening.
We're going to see you next week.
The Corner Store is brought to you by Stolen Spirits.